It's Saturday, April 14th, 2007, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today, a special on location of Geek Speak, our Week in Geek news segment, and questions from our live audience here in downtown Santa Cruz at Loud Nelson Community Center.
Geek Speak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
It's time now for Geek Speak. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. Here with me at the Loud Nelson Community Center are geeks Miles Elam, a Slacker geek and student, Sean Cleveland, technical marketing manager at NVIDIA, and special guest Alex Leas, application security analyst for Fidelity National Financial, and operating the board is Josh Weiss. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning, Lyle.
Before we get into answering questions and speaking with the members of the Senior Commuter Center of Santa Cruz, let's do some geek news. I got to say that again. The members of the Senior Computer Center of Santa Cruz, which is located at Loud Nelson Community Center. Let's do some geek news, and I would like to start this morning with Sean.
All right. Good morning, everybody. It's nice to be live. This is our first time in 6 years since we've done this, so bear with us. So IBM has achieved a breakthrough in developing a three-dimensional semiconductor chip. So as chips now that are in computers and practically every digital device that we have are laid out horizontally on a board. And that's how you connect different chips to each other with internal wires that are 1/1,000,000,000th the size of a human hair. Now it's taken a long time to get to this point, but now they can stack them vertically. So chips are going vertically.
So meaning multiple processors, of course, would be on different stacks?
Different chips entirely. Instead of laying them out horizontally on boards, they can now be stacked vertically on the same chip. What this means is devices can get smaller, they can get faster, you can add more functionality into a device where you couldn't before. It's kind of a big breakthrough, and IBM, of course, they're the ones who did it. And they're looking at these chips hitting the market somewhere around 2009, 2010.
Is it going to help with heat distribution? Having it stacked?
Yeah, I think heat's going to be one of the biggest issues they're going to have to overcome. Believe it or not, getting the wires to go up through the chips has been very difficult.
That's like in my house, too. I got to drill through the floor.
You have to drill through the floor, right? Well, they got to do it at a really small level. We're talking chips the size of your fingernail.
With millions of transistors.
With millions of transistors being stacked on top of each other.
That's small.
Well, hundreds of millions of transistors.
Really?
So a transistor is basically just a little wire, and it's either on or off, just like any computer processor. And you've got hundreds of millions of these that are either in an on or off state, and that's what allows you to use your computer.
That's good.
So now they're stacking these on top of each other, and it's kind of interesting the way they're doing it. They're actually making the holes in the chips, stacking them, and then filling the holes to make the connection.
So you got to pour the liquid in.
It's like liquid metal in. It's like building a building, I guess, right?
Well, thank you, Sean. Yeah. I'm going to go now to Alex.
All right. Actually, just this week we had Microsoft release its vulnerability patches. About once a month they release security updates as well as bug fixes and other updates. And it happens this last week. There is some serious vulnerabilities that are actually out there. And I'd recommend everybody needs to keep their Windows computer updated. One of the vulnerabilities actually allows for wormable attacks. What that means is that a virus can actually penetrate into your computer without you having to do anything and then can continue on and kind of work its way from computer to computer within your network.
That's a worm that's out in the wild right now?
There have been some visibility on it. There are some limitations to it in that it can't actually it has difficulty spanning across your local subnet.
That's
so
good.
It needs some sort of way to get into your local network before it can then propagate, but it can't jump
but
out
so you
of
have
a
to
network.
You have to do something.
You have to do something to get it to first get it into your network, yeah.
Like go to a web page?
You can go to a web page.
I do that a lot.
That's actually one of the biggest ways. Web page, email attachments. Always be wary and where you're going and trust what site you're going to. Don't click anything that you don't know what it is and don't recognize.
Is this the cursor vulnerability that has to do with the mouse cursor, the icon?
No, this is entirely different. I forget the exact specifics of it, but it's...
And what operating systems does it affect?
Pretty much every... Correction. Windows 2000, Windows 2003, and Windows XP.
That was a cheap shot, Lyle.
All right, thank you very much, Alex, for that. Miles, since you're insulting me, go ahead.
Speaking of Windows, Microsoft has announced that Windows XP will not be sold to computer manufacturers at the end of this year.
Replacing it with Vista.
Right, replacing it with Vista. What people have found with the new version of the operating system with Vista is that people have been having some problems requesting at such a large demand that computer makers like Dell have been putting XP onto new machines instead of Vista if the user requests it. However, Microsoft, despite this user demand, has stated that they will stop selling OEM licenses of XP to these vendors to be placed on new computers. Beginning in 2008, all new computers will have Vista. XP will no longer become available.
Now, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
From a consumer standpoint, choice is always good. So having fewer choices, I think, is always a bad thing. From Microsoft's standpoint, it means one more operating system that they have to keep maintaining. It means that it extends the amount of time that they have to continue doing bug fixes and security fixes and tech support for it. So it's that give and take between how much, you know, how cost effective it can be for them. For them, it's most cost effective to concentrate on one operating system and just fix the bugs in Vista and have everyone migrate.
Okay, are any of us using Vista as their primary operating system on our Windows machines? Sean? Miles? Sean? No?
Not I.
Well, and why not?
I do. I run it on several systems at work. I have a little test lab, and I have to test not only 32-bit, but 64-bit versions of both Windows XP and Vista.
But you're not using it as your operating system at home?
No, certainly not using it to do work on.
Okay. No. Thank you very much, Miles, for that. Sean, I'd like to go back to you.
All right, let's talk about cement.
Okay.
Cement.
The ingredient in concrete, as I recall.
It is. Well, a team of researchers at Tokyo Institute of Technology has developed a new type of cement called alumina cement that can conduct electricity like metal.
Oh, good.
So the first thing you think of is, you know, the pad your house sits on can now conduct electricity and possibly...
That's about grounding, huh?
Possibly you could just plug something into your cement, right?
And, you know, I'm just thinking of lightning strikes. I mean, you're standing on a cement, normally you'd be fine. You just electrocute yourself right there.
But this is not how they're going to be using it.
Oh, good.
At least we're hoping.
So they're going to make bathtubs out of it, right?
So they're looking at... well, the way they've done this is they've taken the compound along with titanium inside a glass tube. They heat it to 1,100 degrees so that the cage structure of the cement becomes symmetrical. That's why it conducts electricity.
Wow.
At the cellular level. And then what they're going to do is they're going to make sheets of this that can actually be used in LCD and plasma screens to replace a rare metal known as indium. So cement will be used, you know, in displays.
Does anyone concerned about weight?
I was going to ask, how much does this weigh compared to what they're using now?
These are going to be such fine amounts that, and they're talking at the nano level.
So this is kind of getting to the area of ceramics.
Yes.
Okay.
Very much so.
All right, Sean, thank you very much for that story.
Think of it as a thin membrane, so it won't be that heavy.
Can we make our house foundations out of it?
That would be cool.
Yeah.
So a thin membrane of cement on our laptops. Got it.
You know how hard it is to get like wireless signals and FM radio and such in large like concrete structures because, of course, there's steel in it? Imagine if it's solid or if it's really conductive. You wouldn't have any signal at all.
Just use the water pipes.
That's true. Thanks, Sean. Let's do another news story. Who's got the best one?
We've got a YouTube one.
YouTube one. Let's do
all
YouTube.
Right. Apparently, a teen has actually gone and fooled or scammed YouTube into removing hundreds of videos from their site. They basically posed as an ABC executive, and they bought it. I mean, a 14-year-old kid or 15-year-old kid basically, you know, calls them up and is able to fool them into thinking he's an executive. I don't know many 14 or 15 year olds that sound like a complete adult, but they fell for it and they removed all these videos. And I guess the teen has since apologized about it. it's interesting to see that YouTube, which allows anybody to post up videos, has actually fallen prey to a pretty simple scam of just impersonating somebody else, and they didn't verify it or call back or do anything to make sure that they were talking to the people who truly own the content that they were complaining about.
Well, it does make a little bit more sense when you watch the history of this. Companies such as Viacom have actively gone after YouTube, or I believe there is an open suit on them about copyright, about having material that is part of the Viacom-affiliated stations having content up on YouTube. And while there are many people that are saying that that's boosting the popularity of your shows, you're getting more revenue from this, not less, they are still the copyright owners and have stated, no, this isn't going to happen. So now you end up with almost a chilling effect where now a 15-year-old can just say, pretend they are, and there's no back-checking. There's no second check. It's just, oh, we got to get rid of this as soon as possible or else we are liable.
So it makes sense that they jump at the idea that NBC was taking down their content.
Yeah, right.
I like that.
Well, I don't know I'd say it makes sense that they jump. I mean, they should still verify, but they should have a quick process in order to be able to do that and make sure. I mean, because otherwise it just opens them up to completely being destroyed. I mean, how many 15-year-olds can go and try this now? And how many times are they going to fall for it?
And what about 16-year-olds? I mean,
they do
it even better.
And let's not even talk about 17-year-olds.
Yeah, oh, man.
They only got a year left before they're liable for criminal charges.
That's right. You want to do it before you're liable. That's good.
And this also highlights a method that hackers have used for many years. One of the most successful ways of getting a password is posing as somebody legitimate, calling somebody who has the password and asking for it.
Right, social engineering.
Social engineering.
One of the premier shows for Geek Speak years ago, we had Kevin Mitnick on, and Kevin Mitnick's kind of the famous hacker kid who got put in prison. We had him on Geek Speak, and he really talked about how the technology is a second thing when you're trying to take over. You really just want to get people on the phone and have them give you your passwords, and it's a pretty effective way of doing things. Social engineering?
People are actually a lot easier to fool than a computer system is.
You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. We are on location at Loudoun-Noson Community Center. We are the guests of the Senior Computing Center of Santa Cruz. The geeks this morning, Miles Elam, Sean Cleveland, Alex Leas, and Josh is running the board. Though, I don't even think you have a mic. Do you have a mic, Josh? No one hears you then, so I'm going to stop talking about you. The Senior Computer Center of Santa Cruz County offers members affordable opportunities to learn and use both Macintosh and IBM-compatible computers, also called PCs. The Senior Computer Center of Santa Cruz is located within the Loudoun-Noson Community Center in downtown Santa Cruz. The center is an organization of adults 55 years and older who are interested in learning about and using computers. You can learn more information about the Senior Computer Center at seniorcomputer.org, or just go to geekspeak.org. GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. We're going to start taking questions from the audience today. So if you have a question, go ahead and pop up to the mic, and we'll ask away. So please, don't be shy. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KSP. You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. Stay tuned at KOSP for Castle Cottage this morning at 11 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. The geeks today, Miles Elam, Alex Leas, Sean Cleveland, I am Lyle Troxell, and we are taking your questions in the room here at the Senior Computer Center in Loudoun-Noson. GeekSpeak is supported by CruiseIO Internet, offering DSL, broadband, computer rentals, and tune-ups. CruiseIO has retail stores in downtown Santa Cruz and Watsonville. More information can be found online at cruiseio.com or by calling 459-6301. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you. Welcome to Loudoun-Noson.
I'm not hearing you yet. Just one moment. We'll talk a little bit more. First off, I just want to say that we've never done a live audience, and it's a little intimidating. I mean, up and down the central coast of California into Silicon Valley, talking every day, you'd think we'd be used to it. But having you look at us, you know that I actually do have a face for radio. So it's kind of scary. Welcome to GeekSpeak. What's your name?
Bud Winslow.
Bud, welcome.
And welcome to Loudoun-Noson Community Center and the Senior Computer Center. My question, I hear all the time about streaming and podcasting, and I have no idea what that means. Would you explain to me what streaming and podcasting is?
I will talk a bit about it. I don't know if it'll explain anything, but sure. Streaming is the technology of using the internet to kind of transmit an audio signal or video signal. And the general concept is we generate content. At KOSP, for example, we're on 24 hours, 7 days a week. And there's a computer in the room that takes an audio feed from what we broadcast out on FM radio, traditional radio, and it takes that feed, it digitizes it, and it makes it available on a port, if you will, or a place on that computer. And that computer is accessible from anywhere in the world. So if you go to the computer with the right software, streaming reading software, there's a whole bunch of them out there, you can kind of attach that and start listening to it, and you hear the feed that's relatively live. Now, it's got about a minute delay. We're using similar technology right now to get to the radio station. We're using streaming technology, if you will, to broadcast from Community Center here to KOSP, which is on 7th Avenue in Santa Cruz. Podcasting is a little different. Maybe I'll ask someone else to answer. Miles, you want to ask him about podcasting, what that is?
Podcasting is allowing you to have a list of the different shows that are on there, that are out there. People will put up what's known as an RSS feed or an XML feed. It's basically just a file that says, when you go to a web page, this is a list of all of the shows that I have. If you do that for all the people that have shows, then you're going to need a central registry to keep them all straight. And that's things that you'll find with iTunes, for example. They'll have a list of all the technology shows and have them listed
ODO
there.
ODO was another one that we used.
Right. And so there you're able to say, okay, I want this one, and this one.
You can kind of effectively think of it as a channel for a radio station channel to some degree, except for there's millions of them, or like a television channel.
I actually tend to think of it more like TiVo. You're able to say, I want this when it's available, these items. Does everyone TiVo is?
It's similar to a magazine subscription.
Oh, I mean, good.
There we go.
You pick among all of the different magazines, and each month or you know every other month, you get a new edition coming in, except there you actually get every single issue. Whereas with podcasting, you can actually go and look at the program, which is equivalent to like the magazine itself, and see what editions they have available. And they usually summarize the topic, and that you can go and
actually.
I got
one better.
Okay,
go.
Cable TV. Everyone who's got cable TV can choose the shows you want to watch. You go through a menu, and then you select it, and then you watch the show.
But that's streaming because you watch it live.
But on the computer, it's the same thing. You've got a bunch of different shows, and you can go through them, and you can select it and either listen to it live, or you could send it to a device, like we saw earlier, so that you can listen to it at your convenience.
And that's the second half of the podcasting. So normally there's a piece of software in your computer, and you add channels, or you add these things that's called RSS feeds, and they're just text documents that are on the internet. And every time we release a new Geek Speak show, we add a new entry to that text file. And if you have an application that goes and checks every once in a while, at the end of Saturdays, on every Saturday, you'll see a new GeekSpeak one. Your computer will actually download it for you. Then you'll get an audio file on your computer, which is normally an MP3 file. Doesn't really matter. And then to listen to it, you can either sit at your computer and listen with that same application, or you can get what's called a MP3 player, and you can download those files to your MP3 player. And then you can walk around with it and still have the show.
Yeah. No, but if you didn't follow all of that, distilling it down to his point, you can get programs such as ODO or iTunes. They'll have a tab that says podcasts, and you can go and search from there, and they're free.
That's the thing. They're free. There's no technology to pay for these.
And you don't need an iPod to listen to a podcast.
No.
Yeah, that's actually important to know.
They should really be called netcasts, because the name pod and iPod gets very confusing.
Apple did not invent the technology either.
No.
All right, let's go ahead and go ahead and stand up for the next question. We got to keep talking about this, but yeah, if you have a question, please. And what's your name?
My name is Russ Nelson. I'm from Scotts Valley, and my first question is, which one of you is Bob Barker? Am I on The Price Is Right? My question, the serious question is, I have a hearing problem.
What?
And my wife tells what?
What? Go on.
Oh, you're way ahead of me, pal. And my wife says she can hear the modem, and I've never been able to hear it. So,
what's your problem?
A few weeks.
That's perfect.
A few weeks ago, she said she couldn't hear it, and I thought her hearing was going too. So I went and bought a new modem. I won't tell you where I bought it. Doesn't matter. I installed it, which was scary to get inside the PC, and I didn't electrocute myself. But I installed it, plugged it all back together, and I can hear it now.
The no!
The new one is loud. I can hear it. And then I pick up a telephone. I listen to that. And I can hear it, you know, dialing and making all that squeak, squeak, squeak noise.
Yep.
But it says it can't open the page.
So you still don't have internet access.
What's wrong?
So many things. No, stay up at the mic in case we want to ask you a question again. Anyone want to attack this?
That's been so long since I've installed a modem. Do you remember the error message you get? Do you remember what it says exactly?
No, there's no audio.
There's no message at all. It just doesn't work.
It says can't open the page.
Okay.
Yeah. So you think you've established a connection, and then when you go open your browser, it says there's no connection.
But you can hear it.
Okay. Yeah.
On the phone, you can hear it on the phone.
But it won't open the page. It's attempting to make it a connection. It doesn't actually mean that it has made a connection.
So unfortunately, your modem's communicating kind of like my 2-year-old on the phone. There's sounds happening, but no one's understanding anything. So that's kind of what's happening. And most likely when you installed your new modem, the application that normally dials that sets up the settings, like what phone number to call, most importantly, and then a username and password, which you have to tell your carrier what to use, those things probably were not set correctly. It's probably what's happening. Do you use Cruzeo?
No, sorry to say.
Who do you use in Scotts Valley for your...
We were AT&T, and then we switched to EarthLink.
EarthLink
has a lot more positive things going than AT&T.
Yeah. Do you have an answer to this question?
No, but he got online for about 5 minutes.
Okay, so you were able to get online?
Shut down and never got back on again. That's right.
That may be on the ISP.
So it connected,
that he is
but am
actually
I a
connected
bad modem?
Yeah, you may be connecting to the ISP just fine, and it may be your carrier that's having a problem going out, like a DNS problem. Yeah.
Have you called the company that you're paying for service from?
Not yet.
I would definitely call them.
Yeah.
You got a quarter? I'll give them a call.
Yeah, let me give you my phone. I think you should definitely call them, because I think what's happening is the settings aren't set up correctly, or they're not thinking you're trusted. I guess it's possible that...
Or they just may be having some intermittent connectivity problems. Yeah. How long has this been going on?
Since December.
Okay.
How are you surviving without internet for that long?
Well, we went away for 3 months. We went to Arizona. So we just got home and I bought the new modem and plugged it in, and three, 4 minutes worth, shut down again.
Very strange. Does that happen every time you start up the computer to try to connect? Three or four minutes of access and then it closes?
No.
No.
That only happened once.
Just to show that everything's right.
I have a quick question also. Now, when you go and you have it working, did you pick up the phone when it disconnected?
Yes, and you can hear the zip beep beeps and all that stuff.
But when you picked up the phone, was it no longer working after you picked up the phone?
No, you can still hear it.
Okay, but, I mean, as far as you were able to access the internet, you said it worked for about 4 or 5 minutes?
I got so excited when it connected, I didn't pick up the phone to listen. So
okay, no, good. Oh, good. That's good, because I was thinking that maybe the picking up the phone was causing it to lose its ability to.
No, it wasn't that. It just shut down after 3 or 4 minutes. My wife says we need a new PC, and I think it can be fixed.
Who's right? I think you're probably both right. Thank you for the question.
Thank you.
Good luck. Go ahead, and somebody else can step up if they'd like to ask a question. Yes. What's your name?
My name is Jim Spano. I'm from Santa Cruz.
Welcome, Jim.
And
hi, Jim.
I had a question regarding using your computer as an e-fax machine.
Okay. Thank you. I think we can address this one while you sit down, if you'd like. All right, so...
It just so happens that someone on the panel has worked for an electronic fax company.
That actually merged with e-fax right after I left. So I used to work for a company called JFax, and what they do is they take your email and... or take your faxes and send them to your email. So that's the general idea. There's always been modems, almost all modems of this day... have actual fax support. So you shut the computer off as a modem, you don't go connect to the internet, and you let someone call in and you set up the right fax software, you can actually receive a fax on your computer if you have a modem and a phone line. That's pretty common. Getting the application to work, I don't know them right now. But the other thing you could do, because a lot of people are switching to high bandwidth stuff, is you can register this company, eFax, for example, is the one that's kind of doing it right now, and you sign up with them, and they give you either a free far away phone number, or you can pay for a local phone number in your area, and that phone number is a real phone line. People can call up, they can leave voice messages on it, and they can also fax to that line. So it's like a real phone line that has no actual phone. It actually sits in some server closet in some city. So if you get a free account and you live on this coast, the west coast of the United States, you'll get a phone number in D.C. or something. So everybody that wants to fax you has to call a long-distance phone number if it's a local call, and that's kind of how they make their money. So if you pay for it, something like $10, I'm not really sure, a month, you get a local phone number, looks like a normal phone number, you put it on your business card, you can call up and you can leave voice messages on it saying, you know, okay, you've reached Lyle Troxell and blah, blah, blah. Any messages that come into that line get emailed to your email address, so you have to have email. and you get an audio file that you can play on your computer, or you get an image of the fax. And there might be some optical character recognition where it'll take the image and make it text so you can edit and stuff, but most likely it's just going to be a large TIFF file. So that's how eFax works. It's a paid-for service or a free service if you like giving everybody a long-distance phone number. So the other thing you could do is if you sign up for the service free, it used to be this way when I worked there, we weren't that good, you could sign up, say you lived in New York, you'd get a California phone number, and you really lived in California. But of course, that's against their policy. If you find out you do that, they turn you off. A little bit of hacking there. Next question, please. Did that answer your question? You can go ahead and nod if you'd like, or you have more? Go ahead.
Well, I assume then that if you get it as an email, then you can print it as a fax, right?
Yes, you can print it like you would normal document in your computer. Okay. Definitely. So it's a pretty good solution. The other thing that's great is if you get a lot of fax, you're not going through paper because you only have a digital copy until you want to print it. I'm going to do a little bit of a little announcement thing. So if you want to stand there, please do. I'm so sorry about this. GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, and offering one appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. The Geeks this morning, Sean Cleveland, Miles Elam, Alex Lias. I'm Lyle Troxell. And I just read the end of the show stuff instead of the middle of the show stuff. Oh, confusing. We are at the Senior Computer Center of Santa Cruz. They're hosting us to answer their questions, and we're not taking calls today. If you'd like to, let's see, I've lost my place on here. Okay, good. Okay, here we go. This is Central Coast Public Radio. Okay, talk about the geeks. GeekSpeak is supported by Cruzeo Internet, offering you a DSL, broadband, computer rentals, and tune-ups. Cruzeo has retail stores in downtown Santa Cruz and Watsonville. More information can be found online at cruzeo.com or by calling 459-6301. Miles, why don't you read that now?
Okay.
Sorry, man. We'll get it really mixed up today. Go ahead.
Listen to the sound of Young America, Sunday evening at 6 p.m. This week, a visit to two versions of NBC's famous headquarters, 30 Rockefeller Center. Brian Stack works in 30 Rock as a writer and performer for Late Night with Conan O'Brien. Jack McBriar works in a fictional version of the iconic building. He plays the lovable NBC page Kenneth on the sitcom 30 Rock, which is set at a fictional NBC sketch comedy series. Listen to the sound of Young America Sunday evening at 6 p.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
Thank you, Miles. Now, you've been so patient, so sorry about this. What is your question? What's your name?
I'm Marilyn Rigler.
Marilyn, thank you for standing up there for so long and while we talked.
Welcome.
What's your question?
My question is for Alex. I was reading the news from Small Dogs Electronics in Vermont, and they were lamenting the fact that Tiger, the new system, was delayed and would probably not come out until September or October. Well, I don't know what Tiger is. Can you explain that?
Okay. What was the name of the company you were talking about?
Small Dog Electronics in Vermont.
Okay, I'm not familiar with them. Let me see if I can look them up.
But you know
anybody
the story, right?
I know the story. No, I'm not familiar with the story.
What happened is Apple releases operating systems pretty regularly, and they're normally paid-for operating systems. The current version is called Tiger. The next version, I think, is called Leopard. Is that right?
Yeah.
That's
Leopard.
Correct.
And recently, Apple, normally they release their stuff in June when they have this big show. And everybody's kind of expecting this new operating system because they've been talking about it for a year. In any case, this June, they're going to release the iPhone, and that's a new portable phone that's all Apple and all buzz and everybody loves it. Anyway, the engineers have had a lot of trouble with it, and they've taken all the engineering resources at Apple and thrown it at the iPhone, and so the iPhone's going to be ready in time, but the operating system's going to lag behind. And so the next version of the Macintosh operating system, which if you currently have a Mac, you'd have to pay for, is coming out in October instead of June. Answer your question? So the reason why they're called cats, they like that name. You know, they got all these cat names, and there's every version of the operating system since 10...
I think they started with Puma.
Yeah, Puma and, gosh, I don't remember them all. But Jaguar.
Panther.
Panther, Tiger. In any case, they're just names so that we think of them friendly. And also they know how to color the boxes that the operating system comes in.
And this happens all over Silicon Valley. Things get delayed because lack of resources. There just aren't enough engineers and people to work on things. And that's because, as Lyle likes to say, technology is difficult.
I think I say hard, but yeah, difficult, yeah.
You do. You say technology is hard. And there's a lot going on. And we're constantly trying to not only make a new product better, we're trying to add new features. And those things require more engineers, and Apple's going through that right now. with the iPhone, because this is a whole new experience for them. They've never done a phone before.
Yeah. Go ahead, and someone else can step up to the mic. I just want to say that it's true. When you're doing software development, or especially hardware development, it's amazing that we get so much technology out. We have this amazing plethora of technology, because it's a lot of work. What's your name?
My name is Wolfgang Rosenberg.
Wolfgang,
and I'm from Santa Cruz and a proud member of the Senior Computer Center. And I have a political hot potato.
Uh-oh.
I'm confused this week because I'm learning from all the media commentators that some emails can be kept, some emails can be lost, and some emails can be found. Could you give us a little explanation of why some emails are easily lost and why some other emails are a matter of permanent record?
All right. Thank you very much for the question, Wolfie.
I think I'd like to try and field this one at first. Let's start with the way email works. Okay, it starts from your computer. You type up your email, and your computer connects to whatever mail server your provider, your internet provider, gives for you to connect to. And you give that message to your to the mail server. It then reads, checks the messages for who to go to, and once it identifies on where to pass it on to, it kind of relays it from server to server until it gets to the final destination inbox. Now, the servers that it goes between don't keep a copy of your message. They kind of just check it and then pass it on. The final server that does hold your message will keep it until you delete the message. In the particular case that you're referring to, the claim is that the servers that were used actually delete messages after 30 days. And it's very, very likely that that could be the case.
That's a retention policy. A lot of IT people say the retention policy is in place because they need the space. If you collect email, it's like spam. It just collects and it can actually slow things down. And of course, other people believe that retention policies are in place for other reasons. Litigation, if the email's not there, it can't be used against you. And so it's not only deleted off the server, but it's deleted on people's machines too, from the server.
Yeah. In the case of the recent news items about emails not being saved, and they should be saved. Any emails that are coming to or from the White House, according to an executive order a few presidents back, all of them had to be retained. I think it was during the Ford administration as a response to the Nixon administration, the missing, what was it, 18 minutes of audio. And aides in the White House have been emailing using a Republican National Committee email address. And by there, the Republican National Committee has no formal retention policy to keep those emails, and that's where the big problem is. So really what it comes down to in this case for when are emails saved and when are they not may in fact just be along the lines of are the emails politically expedient to keep around or not, rather than an actual technological problem.
Limitation.
Yeah.
Does that address the question? I hadn't heard anything about the story. Is it a big political hoo-ha?
Yeah,
it's really blowing up. It really is being thought of in much the same way as the missing audio time on the Nixon tapes, because there's that big brouhaha about the Attorney General and the like, that they want to have this information available, and now it's not.
Do you think there might be legislation to enforce that politicians use certain email addresses for their business?
There already is.
So this was against policy.
Yes, this was done in violation of federal statute.
Yeah, the separate email addresses that they use was actually created so that they can do unofficial communications through at least some sort of email address that they're provided with. But another thing also in regards to that case is they're looking, last I had read up on it, they were looking to do some forensics work on the servers themselves, which what they're probably going to be doing is taking the hard drives and scanning the actual platters of the drives.
Inside the drive.
Inside
actually
the
removing
drives.
The platters from the hard drive.
Right, and they'll be looking at each of the ones and zeros and try and find, even when you delete data, sometimes there's a residual mark of that data, so they can try and pull out the data off the drive. It's the same kind of stuff that the FBI or other agencies use when they're confiscating computers for some sort of legal case.
That's a pretty good point. The data that goes on your hard drive is pretty much always there forever, even when you write over it. So you can reformat a hard drive or use it for a while, and people can actually recover some of the older data. If you're really paranoid about your data, you'd actually need to physically destroy the drive. Would the geeks agree with that?
Well, you can use some software that will do what's called a wipe. It'll rewrite random data over the platter
six times, and that is extremely difficult.
And then after you're done with that, then you light it on fire.
We'll take another question if someone would like to come up. Are you ever that paranoid about the data you have on your computer?
No, I'm not at all.
Even that, or
you can use encryption. Actually, the encryption technologies being used today are good enough that it would take all the computers in the world together, even with Moore's Law, the new computers coming in at the same rate, several centuries, if not millennia, to get that data back. So
at least right now. In a couple of years, they'll have chips out.
No, I mean, even taking Moore's Law into account, they're finding that it would take that long to crack.
Yeah, but soon they're going to stack computer chips on top of each other. So
true.
More, yeah.
They didn't take stacking chips.
I guess the only way those things are really going to get cracked would be quantum computing, if that actually comes to fruition. But let's not talk about that. Let's take your call. Your question. Call. It's not calls. You're standing here.
Right.
Please.
My name is Elaine Rolfes. I live in Santa Cruz County. And I have a problem in that email that I sent to a friend, and she tried to reply back to it. And when she tried to send the reply, it came back to her saying, not able to send, or blah, blah, blah. She was not able to reply. And
can she send you email in general?
Yes, she could send me a straight email.
Okay, but she can't seem to reply to you.
Yeah, and I thought it was maybe on my end, but I checked with my server. I checked with my server, and in fact, the gal at the server place, she sent me an email. I mean, she replied to my email, so I know that
she replied
other people could reply to my email. So I figured, well, it's probably my friend's computer,
Josh,
but I don't know what would be the problem.
Our geek over here without the mic, Josh, has sent a message. It might be the reply to address in her email.
I was getting to that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He's sitting over there. He's got all the time in the world.
Actually, well, Josh has got to get some credit. I mean, for all the work he's done with this.
He typed it faster than I could say it, that's for sure.
I do have a follow-up question. I mean, that could be a possibility, but I have seen it before where you try and send mail. You said the error message. What was the error message she would get?
Was it
just like saying you can't send a mail or the mailbox is not found?
I forgot. She told me, but I forgot.
Do you know who she uses for her internet?
No. Okay. Well, this was just through Hotmail. This was her Hotmail address.
Okay, so Hotmail is it. So the thing that I would like to ask about this is, do you send emails to people and do they reply to you relatively frequently? Mm. Are you pretty sure that your replying is working? People will reply to you?
Yeah.
And a good way to tell that is when you send a message, you'll put a subject line in, and later if someone talks to you again, if there's a re in front of that.
I get replies.
So because you normally get replies from people, I would assume that it was her connection that was having difficulties. There's a couple things that could happen. Your mailbox could get full for a while, and the mail server then wouldn't accept any more messages because it was over the quota. It's possible when you called your ISP, the people that give you internet connection, they might have emptied your deleted messages or something. So they might have fixed the problem right then. Optionally, it could have been a problem just at the moment for her on connecting to the internet. She didn't have internet connection, or her outgoing mail server didn't work. There's a few things like that. But one of the things that the thing that Josh had suggested is that we all have our email addresses. We also can say in our email client, please, you know, even though my email address is this and you know what it is, please use this email address to reply to my messages. So there's actually two messages for you. If you send an email message to you, fine. And if that reply to field was wrong and I respect that command, then I would send to that other email and that could be broken. So that was kind of the attempt. But since other people are replying to you, I think you're okay. I think your friend
is. She also mentioned that she's got Hotmail, though. Her friend's got
Hotmail.
Yeah,
see, it shouldn't mess up.
Like, yeah, that makes it even harder to
That means the error message must have been some kind of bounce from the server.
So from her server?
From your server, possibly.
Okay, I called the people from my server, I said, has anybody else called in with this problem? Because it was over the weekend. And she says, I haven't heard anybody, no other person has called in.
There is some unreliability on the internet. And normally, if you get an error like that, trying it one more time is a good idea. If she's definitely having trouble sending email, that means thousands and thousands of users are having trouble with Hotmail. So it's probably something with your connection. The other thing is she might have edited the email address when she said reply to. She might have accidentally put your name in or something like that, and that will really cause a problem. So since you're able to send email now and just test to see if she can reply to your email message, and if she can now, one-time fluke. Thank you, though, for the question.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Elaine?
Could the reply keep going back and forth until it got too big?
Okay. The question was, can the reply email, the thread, go back and forth, and every time the message gets longer and longer, can it get too big? If you've got a lot of time to reply to messages, it could get too big.
If you're just doing text, if you're not putting an attachment on there, that's really not a possibility. Most email servers will handle up to, say, 10 megabytes.
And how many letters is that?
You're talking along the lines of
like 10 million.
You're doing the equivalent of maybe a couple dozen complete works of Shakespeare.
So if you can type that much in your email, then you might have a problem. But basically, 10 million letters. That you'd be sending. Like A, B, C, that kind of letter. Your question, what's your name?
Lindsay Freeman.
Lindsay.
I'm from Santa Cruz. This is actually pretty much a question directed at Sean, I think. I have a laptop with an NVIDIA graphics card on it, and I've been experiencing a lot of lockups in computer games for some reason. And at first I thought it was a driver issue, and I've upgraded to drivers that weren't even supported by Dell, and it's still locking up, and I'm not exactly sure what's going on with it.
Are you a member of the Senior Computer Center?
Yeah, I'm kind of like a repair person.
Okay.
That helps them out.
Okay, you can be here then. It's okay. All right.
It's a Dell, you said?
Yeah, it's a Dell Inspiron 9300.
Right. What's the graphic chip in it?
It's a 6800 Go.
Okay.
Kind of like a mobile graphics
card. And the system only locks up when you're playing games?
Yeah. I do like a lot of 3D graphics work and stuff, and normal usage is fine, but several of the games I own, it can be random. I mean, sometimes I can play it for hours and nothing happens, and other times it's a hard lock, too. It's just like the game just like freezes up, and I have to do a hard shutdown to get back.
But when you come back into the computer, it still works?
Yeah. Yeah, there's nothing wrong.
It's usually when something's overheated, it's not going to boot back into Windows right away.
Yeah, well, I boot back into it, and the card does get kind of hot. I can feel it.
Yeah.
How long until the game stops working?
It can be random. Sometimes I can play for half an hour, and then it locks up. Other times I can play like three or four games at a time, and it doesn't have any.
Just because
problems.
The chips are hot doesn't mean that's an issue. Chips are meant to run hot. Some chips can run up to 70, 80 degrees Celsius, which is, I mean, you couldn't touch, you'd burn your finger. But the chips can do that these days. So that's not so much an issue, unless you're putting it on your lap, right? But I think what might be going on is you've updated the driver. And even if you do a full uninstall of the driver, a lot of stuff gets stuck behind in what's called the registry, which is where all of the information from Windows resides. Something I've seen with some versions of our drivers, in fact, that can happen. And there's software like driver cleaning that can fix that. And there are specific things you can do in the registry to fix that. And I could probably send you something that would help with that. That possibly could be a driver issue.
Yeah, because it's odd because Dell is not too good about keeping their graphics card drivers updated. And the last ones they released were like last year in July. And when I first got the laptop, nothing was wrong at all. Everything was fine. And then when I upgraded to the drivers they released in July, that's when the problems started happening.
Right,
and it's kind of been like a year long, you know, trying. And I've been going into other sites and getting the newest drivers that have like modified files to support other cards.
Right.
And trying to upgrade that, and the problem still remains.
Now, I don't know. A lot of times, desktop driver is not meant for a notebook because notebook chips are different. They're made different because they've got to run cooler. And they don't have all of the features the desktop chip is going to have because of that. If they added all of those things in to make your game play better, the chip would run way too hot for the notebook. And you're talking about a really thin, half an inch to an inch piece of, you know, metal that your keyboard has to sit on top of. There's a lot going on there. So you're almost always better off getting the video driver from the manufacturer of the notebook.
Does someone like Dell actually update their drivers when new drivers come out?
They should, yeah.
They should.
Well, they haven't been because these are an older machine, a year old. And, there's a lot of features.
You can also try to dumb down the game a little bit and try to, and there's normally an option screen.
Yeah.
You can drop the resolution, do other things, and see if you can find what the error is. Like if it's anti-aliasing that's actually causing the crash, it's hard to find. You can also just not play as many computer games. But thank you thank you so much for the question.
That's not an answer.
That's an answer. It's not
also,
a good answer,
you know,
it's an answer.
Sometimes fans go out, you know.
That's a good point.
So make sure your fan's working.
They're actually one of the most common things to go out. They're the moving part that will collect dust.
Because if your fan goes out, then, you're going to experience lockups and all kinds of weird behavior. because the chip's running too hot.
Not to mention if you notice your computer getting a lot louder. Like you're saying, hey, the hard drive sounds like it's making a lot of noise. It's usually not a hard drive. It's usually a fan. Like the CPU
but it could
fan.
Be the hard drive, which means your hard drive's about to die.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Hi, welcome. I mean, I keep on saying welcome, but we're the guests here. So hello, what's your name?
Alan Schlanger.
Alan?
Welcome.
Thank you.
I've listened to your program often. And
I'm sorry for that.
And it's nice to see the faces behind the voices. Question about Macintosh, Intel. They've had the Intel chip out for over a year now. I'm interested in your thoughts on how that has worked for
Yummy.
Apple's profitability and security.
Okay, good. Well, first off, let's talk about that. I think I'm the only one running an Intel Macintosh. So these two computers are the older technology made by Motorola, I think.
Yep, GeForce.
GeForce, and this one's an Intel. And you've got probably Intel or AMD.
Yeah,
processor?
I have a Intel.
But you're not running Macintosh.
But it's the previous generation. It's not a Core.
Right, so this is a Core 2 Duo. It's a pretty good chip. They're a lot faster than GeForce, so the technology in that sense is extremely good. The security issue, Alex, you're kind of our security expert. What do you think?
Yeah, as far as security, it's most vulnerabilities, most attacks on computers usually attack the software that's installed. So if you happen to install Windows on your Mac, which when I eventually get an Intel, I'll probably end up having both running myself, but that could still be just as vulnerable as any other Windows machine. But the Mac operating system running on the Intel processor is no more vulnerable, well, reasonably no more vulnerable than the older G4 versions.
And, you know, we should say that there's a large argument that the reason why Macintoshes don't have as many viruses is not because necessarily they're better designed or anything. It's because there's a lot less of them out there, so there's less incentive to take them over. So that argument that wages all the time. And I tend to believe that it's kind of a mix of both. One, that a lot of people aren't targeting them, but also that their security design is better than the Windows design. Would you agree with Miles?
The fact that there are so many college students, for example, that have Macs nowadays, that there hasn't been an exploit, that there hasn't been some bored person in the dorm room making some exploit that takes out a local dorm room release or a computer network, I think does speak to its security.
Okay. Well, and so the next question is, is this Macintosh right here, Alex's and Miles' Macintosh, are those safer from vulnerabilities than my Macintosh? And I would say they're the same vulnerability level. I don't think the hardware is going to affect it very much because it's really the operating system you're going to target.
Yeah, I'd say very much because there have been some vulnerabilities that managed to compromise attacking the hardware or the software that runs on the processors. The BIOS can sometimes be attacked from the operating system. And in that case, it could potentially open it up. But I've never heard of anything with the Intel Macs having that kind of vulnerability.
Thanks for the question. We'll take another question.
Actually, talking about the CPU itself, the Intel Core 2 processor, wow, what a powerhouse. So for a Macintosh or a PC, if you're looking to buy a new computer, laptop or desktop, you're going to get quite a bit of performance out of the new Intel Core 2 architecture.
Hi, Jim, you have another question for us?
Yes, I did. It's probably not very technical as compared to what you've just heard, but when you send someone an email, is it possible to find out if they have read that email or not?
If they agree to tell you, and the software can actually agree for them, but most of the time that response is turned off, and there's a good reason for it. But anyone know about any clients right now that auto respond when you get an email? I don't know of any. Basically, if you send an email message to somebody, you can say, please give me a request back. And there's actually some structure for doing that.
A request that it's been read.
Yeah.
So when you get the email, a little window will pop up and say, would you like to let the person know that you read this email? And they can either choose to say yes or no.
There are some technical geeky tricks, and that has to do with putting an image link inside the email. And basically, most email clients will accept images in line, and you can actually serve that image. Instead of emailing to them, you can point to an image on a web server. And so when they open the email, an image pops up. It actually had to get it from a web server. And if you control the web server, you know that email was requested. And if you put a unique image, if you will, for every email you send, you would know if the person read the message. But
advertisers use that.
That's a spamming technique.
Yes.
And so it's basically frowned
upon. So if you have a good email client, it won't do that. It won't allow that to happen.
Now, also, Outlook actually does allow the option to do automatic You can set it for where a person has to be asked, or the person can set it for themselves to ask them whether or not they want to have the receipt, the return receipt, sent back to them. But that they can set it to be automatic also, where it just always sends it no matter what. So it is possible, but it's not something you can guarantee as the sender.
You can kind of set it up in a corporation if you kind of control the computers for everybody to know when things get sent. And that is sometimes done, or read. Your name?
Robert Van Hook. I'm a resident of Santa Cruz and a member of the Senior Computer Center. My question relates to downloading copyrighted material from the library. You can use an OverDrive video console, and when you do that, it requires you to upgrade the Windows Media Player to accept copyrighted material. And we keep running into a problem that it won't upgrade. It's apparently a problem in the registry. And if you go remove the DRM from the registry, how do you go get the new DRM?
So you're talking about renting DVDs from
the library? No, you're talking about you can go online to the library. You can have an account, and you can. There is audiobooks that can be downloaded for use for up to 21 days. But it's copyrighted material, and your Windows Media Player and XP.
Yeah, the new version, Windows Media 11, will actually, when you try and open a file that it believes is copyrighted, it will try and connect to an external server to get permission for that file to be played. Digital rights management is going to be very pervasive and invasive in our lives moving forward, especially with Vista, where they've made this really difficult to get around. And XP, I believe it's you can go into your Windows Media Player properties in the preferences section,
okay,
where you you select all of the various things that it can do.
Mm-hmm.
You probably go to like edit, preferences. In there, I think you can turn that off in Windows XP. So that it won't do that anymore.
Oh, okay. That may be what it's doing.
If you're in Vista, I don't think you can turn that off.
No, I'm talking about XP.
That's a recommendation. And unfortunately, we are running out of time on GeekSpeak.
You know why? When you first install Windows Media Player, you can select whether to do that there. So you should be able to turn it off.
Oh, okay.
GeekSpeak is supported by Business. Thank you so much for the question. GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. The Geeks this morning with Sean Cleveland, Miles Elam, and Alex Slias. Running the board was Josh. I'm Lyle Troxell. A special thanks to the Senior Computer Center of Santa Cruz for hosting the show today and making us feel so welcome and asking us questions that we were able to answer hopefully correctly. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Ardo. We're streaming and podcasting at kusp.org. Coming up next is Castle Cottage with Susan Freeman. But first, the Slow County Report for KUSP and GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxell. See you next week.